If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Sunday, August 28th, 2022. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Primary season is wrapping up as we move closer to November midterms, and predictions of a big red wave are growing a bit smaller now.
A lot of people were referring to this enormous red wave that was coming. Experience tells us that that kind of language that far out often turns out to be not necessarily correct.
I'm Ryan Schmelz. 1 year after the war in Afghanistan officially came to an end with a chaotic withdrawal, how has the region changed? How is the U.S. keeping us safe from possible terrorist threats in the region? And what is the legacy of how America's longest war came to an end?
We face a greater threat from Afghanistan today than we have ever faced ever in our history.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
As primary season winds down, things are looking not quite as solid for Republicans as we look ahead to November midterms. The Fox News power rankings last week show the GOP is still going to have a good night in the House, but with fewer predicted wins. In July, Fox News estimated Republicans winning enough seats to have a 22-seat majority. This past week, the new estimate is a 16-seat majority. Some Fox News polling out of Wisconsin and Arizona spells trouble for Republicans as well. Incumbent Senator Ron Johnson was behind the Democratic challenger, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, by 4 points. In Arizona, the Trump-backed Blake Masters was behind incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Kelly by 8 points. Last week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was asked his midterm thoughts.
Probably a greater likelihood of House split than the Senate. Senate races are just different. They're statewide. Candidate quality has a lot to do with the outcome.
That was at a Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce luncheon. But one critical thing happened this summer, after which polls started to show more engaged Democratic voters, and that was the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe. The ruling moved decisions about abortion laws back to the states.
I do not believe that this will have a negative impact on us at the polls, to be honest with you.
South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott told Fox News anchor Martha McCallum on the story.
I hope we maintain common sense and keep our focus on the American people and not on November as it relates to this very important issue.
And it remains to be seen what role it will play. In the Fox News poll out of Wisconsin, for example, inflation was still the top voting issue, but abortion was second. In the Fox News poll for Arizona, it was third, behind inflation, which was tied with border security, and only 4 points behind those top two. Meanwhile, Democratic voters made some choices this past Tuesday that may reveal more about their mood. In Florida's governor's primary, they went with former Republican governor turned Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist over the more progressive Nikki Fried.
They want a governor who cares about them, to solve real problems, who preserves our freedom. Not a bully who divides us and takes our freedom away.
Crist will run against incumbent Republican Governor Ron DeSantis in the fall.
You know, it's always a little bit tricky to analyze where the midterms are headed.
Fox News anchor Martha McCallum.
In the last week of summer in August, right before Labor Day. But of course, it doesn't stop us from trying. I think that you're going to see the focus change a lot after Labor Day. But I do think there are a few things that we're kind of noticing that have been happening really over the past month or so. And in many ways, I think you can trace some of it back to the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade. So what was looking like a huge red wave, and I remember thinking, you know, months ago, back when the minority leader of the House, Kevin McCarthy, was talking about this tsunami, and a lot of people were referring to this enormous red wave that was coming. Experience tells us that that kind of language that far out often turns out to be not necessarily correct. So I think what we're seeing is a tightening in this. And I think that the abortion question is a big one that will have some impact in some places. We saw that New York 19 race this week that I think was an interesting indicator. And I think that it's sort of caused a lot of eyebrows to raise on the Republican side of the ledger about how to approach that issue moving forward.
Martha, talk to me about the 19th, because heading into Tuesday, all the analysts and the pundits were like, oh, let's look for tea leaves out of this. It's one of New York's, I guess, most swingy districts. But some other analysts said, wait, before you put too much stock in this, let's just remember this. It's just a 4-month hold, right? And then after that, the district lines have changed anyway. And the Democrat in the 19th, he's actually running in the 18th beyond November. So when Speaker Pelosi says, ooh, look at what happened in District 19, the Democrat won, Republicans should be afraid. How afraid? And is that, how much stock do you think should have gone into this?
Well, you know, I think for all the reasons that you stated, it's just sort of one little data point that you look at, right? But we also look at what happened in Kansas, where the referendum was one of the first opportunities that we saw for voters to go to the polls and let their feelings be known about Roe v. Wade. And what we saw there is that they wanted to keep the restrictions that were in place, which allowed for abortions to be taking place in the state of Kansas. So, which I think is interesting because that's an isolated. So that's almost sort of the interesting barometer, right? When you have referendums, you're having a vote on that specific issue. And I think you're going to see in some of these cases, especially in a place like Kansas, where you might see some people vote in referendum, but then you might see them pick a Republican candidate for Congress or for, you know, for their House seat or for, there's not a Senate race there this time around. But so I think that you can't ignore New York 19. You know, the same could be said about Maya Flores in Texas, which was also a special election, in which a lot of people said could easily turn back around. But I think there is something to pay attention to in both of those races. And I think they are two of the things that we're probably going to be talking about all the way up to the midterms and after. And that's the changing Hispanic vote in America, which is an increasingly conservative group. It's not majority conservative, but for my, you know, entire period covering politics, Hispanics have been a very reliable Democrat vote. And I think one of the most significant things that's changing is watching that. And I think the Maya Flores special election is significant. I think New York 19 is also a data point that's worth paying attention to as well, regardless of the fact that some things could change some of those factors. And it is a late August, not a lot of turnout in that New York race, but it's still something to pay attention to, I think, for both sides.
Martha, this past Tuesday, we also saw Democrats go in a couple of cases with, like, I guess, more moderate candidates, right? They went with Sean Patrick Maloney for a congressional district over a progressive. And in Florida, Charlie Crist won the Democratic nomination for governor over the more progressive candidate. Others, you know, say, wait a second, name recognition is kind of an important talking point here if you want to go down that road. Either way, though, we do have some results in some high-profile cases where the more moderate Democrat won. Do we make anything out of that, or is it, again, interesting data points right now, but wait, like, hold on?
Well, I think you're right that name recognition makes a difference, but you also have people turning out in primary races who are, you know, interested in watching elections. So they're making that active choice to go and vote in a primary, which is, you know, something that only the most committed voters generally do. So my guess is that they've looked at both of these candidates and that the name recognition certainly helps. But I also think that it's an indication that in those races, they're concerned about some of the progressive candidates out there. They want to pick winners. So, and I think it's also something to pay attention to in the discussion that's going on about the candidate quality in some of the Senate races for those who have been backed by President Trump, which is going to be a huge test of his ability, even though he has done extraordinarily well in terms of how his endorsements have fared in the primaries. The real test is going to be in the general, and that's going to be one of the big storylines to watch as well. But it's that question of, you know, of a candidate who can likely win that may be causing them to lean more towards moderates. And you look at the contrast that you see in the Senate races in Georgia and Pennsylvania and Arizona. And that's another really interesting thing to watch in all these races.
Let's talk about the Fox News power rankings. GOP still forecast to have a pretty good night, but less so, which is in line with our conversation. But in that light, when we talk about the overturning of Roe and enthusiasm on both sides, I read something interesting. It might be more speculative rather than data-driven right now, but does the overturning of Roe possibly lessen or weaken Republican enthusiasm? Like, if this is now settled, okay, back to the states, is that no longer this big driving factor for some or many Republicans?
Well, you know, I think one of the problems is that the issue hasn't been articulated well by Republicans. And I think that people who are opposed to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which is not the overturning of Roe v. Wade is not the banning of abortion across the country. It's the decision that it was not a constitutional decision to be made, that it was wrongly decided in the first place, which you know, decades of justices have discussed, including justices who were more liberal in many of their decisions, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, have questioned that. So I think that the biggest issue and the reason that you're seeing, I think that Republicans are losing the articulation debate on this issue. And I think they need to sort of think about that. If they don't want this issue to get away from them, they have to, you know, talk about, you know, 12 weeks, 15 week issues. They have to talk about the fact that some states in this country have the most lenient abortion laws in the world. And I think that they sort of have glossed over it. I think they ignored how big a story it is and how much of an impact it may have with particularly some, you know, suburban women voters who might have been inclined to make a different choice than the Democrat choice based on inflation and crime and other factors. But we have a poll that shows 21% say that abortion is important enough to them to vote on it as a single issue vote. And we haven't seen that in decades. So I think that it's really an issue of how they're discussing it and a failure to get certain points across in terms of making it a fair argument.
As you know, last week, Republicans got some tough news about some of those Senate races that you referenced, even some governor's races. The Fox News polling showed incumbent Senator Ron Johnson in Wisconsin behind the Democratic challenger. As you noted, the Republican challenger in Arizona is behind the Democrat there, incumbent Mark Kelly. We're seeing reports about Senate Democrats outraising Senate Republicans and some really double-digit polling out of Pennsylvania showing Dr. Oz really struggling against John Fetterman. When you drill down in that Fox News data on Ron Johnson's race, for instance, in Wisconsin, the independents and the moderates are overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidate. Is that a Ron Johnson issue, or is that something bigger along the lines with what we've been talking about, maybe Roe or maybe Senate candidate quality?
It may be a Ron Johnson issue. I mean, Senate races are different because they're statewide. And I think, you know, he has had a, you know, he's been very outspoken on a lot of Trump-related issues. And that may be working against him to some extent with some of those moderate independent voters in Wisconsin. I think that, you know, the Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is a compelling candidate in Wisconsin. I think that's going to be a very interesting race to watch. You know, the idea of candidate quality is just a huge question mark right now. So we watched these primary races happen. We saw President Trump, former President Trump, come out really backing some controversial candidates, Herschel Walker and Blake Masters in Arizona. We saw him come out in favor of Dr. Oz over David McCormick, who a lot of Trump people who worked in the Trump administration were actively working on his behalf. So I think, you know, if it turns out that those people lose those races, that's going to be the conversation on midterm election night. You know, what's the impact on President Trump here? Because so far he's ridden this wave really well in terms of these picks through the primaries. But, you know, if McConnell and Trump, and the differences that they've had over these candidates end up leaving the Senate, or even in a situation where you see Democrats increasing their majority in the Senate, that will be seen as an enormous failure on the side of Republicans. So it's too early to say. And I noticed recently in some of the polls that, like, the Georgia race is tightening up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of this is going to get a lot more interesting in the weeks to come. And it is too early to say at this point. But that's a major benchmark to watch, because one of them is right, one of them is wrong between McConnell and Trump on these candidates. And we'll see. You know, we'll see. It's going to be a big story.
Martha, to that point, briefly, just to wrap it up, Mitch McConnell did say that candidate quality matters here. And mm-hmm. former President Trump said those, you know, why are Republican senators allowing broken down hack politician McConnell to openly disparage these candidates? This infighting, it can't help in November.
No, it really can't. And I think that, you know, those are it's interesting, right? When you have a soft sounding phrase like candidate quality, or you have some people referring to them as new candidates, you know, candidates who have not been tested before, who haven't run. But those are fighting words. Those are fighting words to the former president.
Yep.
And they are putting him in a spot where if these people lose, they're going to blame him. And maybe, you know, maybe they'll see that as sort of a tool to sort of hold him back. Because, look, it's an extraordinary story. The story of Donald Trump is one of the most extraordinary political stories that I think any of us has ever witnessed. And so mm-hmm. now here he is, sort of trying to rise from the ashes and prove that he still has hold over the party, that he still is the kingmaker for these candidates. He's managed to wrestle out of office 8 of the 10 people who voted to impeach him from his own party. And, you know, this is what makes covering this an incredibly dynamic, historic situation. So it's going to be fascinating to watch.
Fascinating is the word. Martha McCallum, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you again. Take care.
This week marked 1 year since the United States military completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan. And earlier this month, the U.S. announced the killing of al-Qaeda's terrorist leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, one of the last living plotters of 9/11, who is being harbored by the Taliban in the capital city of Kabul. Americans are wondering how the U.S. plans to keep citizens safe from future terror threats.
Well, I think the concern that we always had was that al-Qaeda was not eliminated in Afghanistan. And that, coupled with the fact that the Taliban was strong and able to now take over the country again, has put our country, the United States, at great risk.
Daniel Hoffman is a former station chief and senior executive clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. And he spent a significant amount of time in the Middle East.
We know one thing from 9/11 is that don't give our terrorist enemies sanctuary, ungoverned space to plot and plan against us. And that strike against al-Qaeda's leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, as momentous as it was, only demonstrated that al-Qaeda enjoys total freedom of movement all the way to what, by, again, Afghanistan standards here, to the elite section of Kabul. And that has to be a concern to us, because we can't get to the same level of resolution on those threats, ISIS and al-Qaeda, that are growing in Afghanistan, since we're not there. And we lost our best ally in the region, the government of Afghanistan, their intelligence service, their special operations military, who fought and in many cases died on behalf of their country and ours to eliminate those terrorist threats before they are visited on our shores. I am extremely concerned about that threat. There's a lot of threats out there, but that's the one with the shortest fuse that we have to be concerned about.
And so piggybacking off that, you know, how is the U.S. operating and launching counterterrorism now that there isn't a military presence in that country specifically?
Well, it all starts with sources, human sources, who tell us where the al-Qaeda operatives are, who they are, what their plans are. And it's really hard to run those sources when you don't have an embassy in the country and you don't have the kind of freedom of movement that we used to have. Taliban is in control of Afghanistan, and it's very tricky for us to get in there and do that sort of work. I can only imagine the challenges that my former colleagues at CIA now face. And look, our generals all argued against the withdrawal. They all argued that we could have kept 2,500 troops there, kept Bagram Air Force Base, maintained a level of connectivity in the country that would have allowed the government of Afghanistan to continue to function. The problem over the years, in my estimation at least, is that we allowed a lot of other things to creep into the mission. We went there to kill Al-Qaeda, to kill bin Laden and eliminate those terrorist threats. And it morphed into nation building. And, you know, I'm all about helping out, you know, minorities and women and other things. But that's not why we went there. And I think we were distracted in a way. And the mission became much too great for our country, sadly, because we face a greater threat from Afghanistan today than we have ever faced ever in our history.
So for you, what was it like watching that evacuation almost a year ago?
Well, the two things that really struck me first was that the administration chose to leave against the advice, guidance of the generals and the intelligence community, who all argued that there was this false sort of portrayal of our options in Afghanistan, either massive amounts of troops, nation building, or just leave. There was a middle ground with very few troops there. We had far fewer troops in South Korea, for example, or in Germany or in Kuwait, you know. So first, the fact that the decision was made that we negotiated with the Taliban, this is the same Taliban. They're no different today than they were in the 90s, except that now they're smarter, they're more sophisticated, they're better armed. And, you know, we just couldn't trust the Taliban to abide by any of the Doha agreements. So that's the first thing that concerned me. And the second thing was the withdrawal itself, which was so chaotic and breaks your heart over the number of Afghans, our allies, who were unable to get out, over our own military, 13 of them who were killed in that strike, you know, at the airport, the suicide attack. You know, it was just an extraordinarily chaotic withdrawal that in and of itself is kind of a catastrophe for us. But it also makes the United States on the world stage look vulnerable. And that's exactly what our enemies are going to play to, like Russia and China, especially, not to mention Iran and others.
How strong is the Taliban right now compared to when the U.S. first entered the country decades ago?
I mean, they're far stronger because they fought and they won an insurgency. So they picked up a lot of support along the way. They really aren't facing right now any counter forces. There's a small group in the Panjshir, the son of Ahmad Shah Massoud. Ahmad Shah Massoud was killed on September 9, he was the leader of the resistance to the Taliban before 9/11. His son is now leading the effort, but they're not getting any support from anybody outside of Afghanistan. So the Taliban is pretty well in control. But the problem is that they're an insurgent force. They don't have the desire or the capability to really go full force at ISIS. And they are aligned. They are partners with Al-Qaeda. The very powerful Haqqani network has long been an ally of Al-Qaeda. And their leader, Sirajuddin Haqqani, is the Minister of Interior in the Taliban government. And it was Sirajuddin Haqqani who procured that apartment safe house, not so safe, but a safe house where Zawahiri and his family were living when that strike took place. So the Taliban is far more dangerous today than they've ever been.
Fox News reported this week from the U.S. Commission on Internal Religious Freedom, talking about how harshly the Taliban has cracked down on all forms of religion outside of the one that they've been pushing, and even reinstated a ministry of propagation of virtue. You know, since many Afghans have experienced what freedom could be like, and some were able to get educations past what they were able to before, do you think there are resistance efforts in that country that could be a threat to the Taliban, or is that not substantial enough to be a threat?
No, there's no evidence whatsoever that there's any indigenous capability to counter the Taliban. And all of that extremist view of Islam is what aligns the Taliban with the terrorists. And so if you grow up in Taliban-governed Afghanistan, you're more likely to potentially join one of those terrorist groups. And let's remember that Afghanistan is a humanitarian catastrophe. The Taliban is nowhere capable of governing their country. And they're not going to get any support from anywhere outside of Afghanistan, especially after they allowed Zawahiri to have to enjoy sanctuary in their capital city. So look, we kind of left behind a terrorist state. We did leave behind a terrorist state. And I kind of think we failed to follow the Hippocratic Oath of doing no harm, at least, to the situation at hand. We made it a lot worse. Yes, for Afghans, we made it a lot worse, who are now having to live under this barbaric regime. but we made it a lot worse for our allies in the region. Look, Pakistan is a nuclear armed state, kind of teetering on massive political civil unrest, and the Pakistani Taliban, the Taliban inside Afghanistan focused on Pakistan, they have the Pakistani government and the Pakistani nuclear program in their crosshairs. And that's another threat that we face, not to mention the fact that they will all be coming for us here in the United States. And I just feel like this is a poison pill, a ticking time bomb, so to speak, that we've got out there. And our intelligence community, you know, this administration wanted to pivot to China and deal with other things. We're going to have to spend more money, more resources, more people, because we don't have the capability that we used to have in Afghanistan to track those threats. But we've got to do it. And we know we have to do it. And it's just a lot harder and it's a lot more risky.
And you kind of just touched on a little bit on the next question here. You know, what can the United States do and what needs to be done from here?
Well, I think we need to work with our partners, although there aren't very many of them in the region, but there are some with whom we can work. That's the first step. The second step is for us to think about working more closely with the resistance to the Taliban, which we're reportedly not doing. And the State Department publicly has said we're not doing it. And the third thing is, you know, somehow we've got to go in there and collect intelligence. We've got to be honest about it. And I would like to see the Congress hold hearings and bring in the Director of National Intelligence, Evriel Haines, and Director CIA Burns, and ask those questions. They were asked before we withdrew, and Director Burns said, yeah, this will have a major impact on our ability to collect intelligence. Okay, now it's been over a year. Tell us how bad it is. And don't tell me that we have this over-the-horizon capability. That's a wonderfully sounding, pleasant phrase, but there's no such thing as over-the-horizon. You can't see over the horizon. That strike of against Zawahiri, that was over. That was above him. That was not over the horizon. That was in the horizon. We saw him. We tracked him like a sniper, and took the shot. But you know, I'd like to. That question that you ask is a good one. It's got to be posed to the Biden administration. What's your plan now? How are you going to keep our nation safe?
And as we speak of President Joe Biden, as we start to wrap things up here, you know, what do you think of the political fallout that's happened 1 year later? And what kind of do you think the legacy of the withdrawal will be on American history?
So I don't think we've paid a price for it yet. You know, obviously, there haven't been attacks on U.S. persons and installations in the region and here at home. But that Taliban victory for sure has a value to the terrorists as a recruitment tool that the Taliban can show their recruits that, hey, look, we went toe-to-toe with the United States and we defeated the United States in insurgency. And that's our powerful recruiting tool. Again, I feel like when history is written, and look, it may take 15, 20 years from now, who knows, unless we change course and find a way to deal with Afghanistan, it's not going to be kind to this decision. And let's be clear, this decision to withdraw was one that the Trump administration, the Obama administration favored it as well. It's a question, though, of just how we do it. And I'll hold the Biden administration accountable for not challenging their own assumptions and the assumptions of others and maybe swiveling in a better direction to keep our nation safe. Barring something unforeseen, we're going to pay the price down the road. And we'll look at this decision last year as a seminal moment, which put us in the crosshairs of the terrorists. And it was needlessly done so.
And when the Secretary of State kind of put some blame on the Trump administration, saying that, you know, they did not inherit a plan, is that a justifiable criticism or is that an excuse?
The Doha agreement was not a good agreement. We released a bunch of guys that, you know, negotiated that. Berader was one of them. He's a very, you know, he's a killer, a Taliban ruthless killer. And the agreement itself was not a good deal for us. And the Trump administration withdrew a great number of our forces. But at the end of the day, President Biden was the guy who was responsible for that decision to withdraw the remainder of our forces and do it in the way that he did. So he's going to bear the brunt of the responsibility. At this point, you know, I'm honestly less concerned about blaming politicians who are no longer in office. Let's go back over what we did, but now let's find a solution and let's try to see what we can do to improve our situation there, because our nation depends upon it. And I'd like to see some bipartisan consensus and reality. Let's not see the world as we wish it looked and be more honest, intellectually honest, and see it as it is. And I think that's what you know, we all should be holding this administration, the Biden administration, accountable for doing that, for calling out the threats as they exist. And of course, politically, that's not good for them. But for our country, It's a necessity, because if you don't call out the threats for what they are, you're not going to have the resources to deal with them.
All right. And as we wrap things up here, is there anything we missed that you want to add?
I'll just add this point. You know, things are so awfully interconnected. Zawahiri's successor is probably Saif al-Adel, who is currently in Iran right now. And we're on the kind of the precipice here of negotiating a new nuclear deal with the Iranians. And I would just encourage all our listeners to think about the ramifications of that deal, which in and of itself is not going to deal with Iran's state sponsorship of terrorism or their ballistic missile program. And it's got the continued sunset clauses, it looks like, on their nuclear program. But if that deal is made, Iran will be able to evade the sanctions. They won't be there anymore. And they'll be able to import Russian oil and give Russia an economic lifeline. And they've been harboring al-Qaeda. So the next leader of al-Qaeda is going to come from that very country with which we are going to sign this nuclear deal. This is, I mean, it's a wickedly complex challenge for our national security. But again, those are issues, I think, that are going to come up in the near term. Iran is providing Russia with drones to fight in Ukraine. All of this very interconnected and very challenging. But I hope that we can get some bipartisan consensus where Democrats and Republicans can come together and solve these problems.
Daniel Hoffman, thank you very much for your time. And that'll do it for this week's Fox News Rundown from Washington. Next week, we continue to follow the latest of the 2022 primary elections, and we're expected to have more insight into what led the FBI to raid the property of former President Trump. For all of us at Fox News Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Ryan Schmelz from Washington.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.